in like a father addressing his son and calling him out, Ya Bunaya, oh my son, oh my son, oh my beloved son, right. my dear son. Right. So like not just once or twice, it's like 10 times. Mm-hmm. And for every single thing like he wants to say, he wants to explain, like Imam Ali al-Islam to Imam Hassan al-Islam, he would say, oh my beloved son, oh my dear son, you right. see. So this kind of approach we can see from the life of Imam Ali with regards to his son, who is a young person then. And I think we have to take lesson from this particular aspect of the Holy Quran, of the lifestyle of Luqman to his son. And of course, from the Ahlul Bayt, the lifestyle of Imam Ali, or the way he used to show love and affection towards his son. Of course, the same works with the daughters as well. Like we have examples from the life of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, where he used to give utmost respect to his daughters. And the life, and from the life of Rasulullah, he would stand up when Sayyidah Fatima Az-Zahra salamu alayha would enter the house or enter the place where he used to sit. He would stand up. Like right. it shows how. A person, and you know, like Sayyida Fatima salamu alayha was in her teenagers, like of course her martyrdom was when she was just 18, yeah,
right.
So Rasulullah would stand up when she was in her teenagehood, yeah,
right.
So we have to learn this. Of course, I don't say right now a person should change instantly, right. But this is something we have to consider, like showing respect to our children, talking to them very nicely, politely, in a lovable manner, in a manner that they should feel secure. They should feel the love. They should get all the love right. when their parents speaks to them. Yeah?
Right. Inshallah. So even if you're elder, mm-hmm. show them respect, show them humbleness, show them politeness, and do call them with good names. There was a Japanese researcher who did research on water and said that he called two groups of students. To one group, he said that called this water with bad names, and to another group, called the water with good names. And then he took the sample after freezing them. And the bottles, which were called with good names, had made a very good structure when seen under microscope. And also the water that was called with bad names developed very dense black structure, which was very ugly. And then we reached the conclusion that more than 70% of our body consists of water. So when you call your children with good names, definitely they would take good shapes and positive energy. Similarly, our brains, it also contains a lot of liquids. And if we call our children with good names, as suggested in the narrations, so definitely you are actually inducing positive energy into them. Thank you so much, Brother Liaquat, for being with us. That was our today's episode. Dear listeners, if you had any questions or queries, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. If you want to listen to our episodes again, go back to our official website. There's www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and you can go there and you'll find an archive of our programs there. Thank you for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete.
Welcome to a new episode of Israel Watch. Day three of silence again here on the southern suburbs of Beirut. But actually now for the first time, we do have the Israeli entity drones hovering overhead with a nice little sound in the music. What we're going to be starting with today actually is a more depth and elaborated version of who the newly appointed Secretary General of Hezbollah is. As we know, Sheikh Naim Asim, we're going to go back a bit into his history, where he has been before this, and what has brought him or why he has been elected for this very courageous position. In addition, Israel actually has committed another two massacres in southern Lebanon, one in Harat Saida and one in Sarafand, killing at least 20 so far, according to the tolls. Sirens, of course, have sounded in northern and in central Israel with the resistance, Hezbollah drones actually targeting their marks. Senior Biden advisors have arrived to Israel for the discussion of a ceasefire in Lebanon. This is the second time we've heard from the Israeli media that there are reports of Hochstein and others arriving to Israel meeting with Netanyahu. So we're going to go ahead and talk a bit about this. And last but not least, we have Hamas is saying it will respond to the request to discuss new ceasefire proposals from Israel, from Qatar, of course, but of course with their own conditions. So let's go ahead and get started. I'm going to first of all welcome my guest today, Mr. Ali Mourad, writer and political researcher. Welcome, Mr. Ali.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Ali, we're going to be starting, as I said, I want to start off with Sheikh Naim Asim, who has taken a very courageous position, specifically at this time. And it's extremely courageous because a lot of people have described it as a martyrdom operation, taking this position now. What is the significance of the timing of his appointment?
Well, actually, we have seen what has been broadcast in the media, the U.S. media, of course, and the Zionist media, and some Arabic media, that no one from the leaders in Hezbollah is accepting to take the position, and of course, it's a psychological war being projected to the environment here in Lebanon, especially those who support this resistance. They were trying to tell us that that this organization, this resistance, is not safe anymore. Its leaders are not safe anymore, and you know, the intelligence information that led to the assassination of the leaders, Sayyid Nasrallah, Sayyid Safiuddin, and all the military leaders of the resistance, would suggest to those people in Lebanon that the Zionists are capable of reaching anyone who takes the role of leadership. But it's obvious that when the Hezbollah declares that there is a new Secretary General, it means that the Shura Council were able to meet,
yes,
and to discuss who is eligible to take the position, to be elected to this position.
And just for the Western viewers, I'm sorry, Mr. Ali, could you explain what the Shura Council is?
Well, actually, when Hezbollah was founded, it was founded by like less than 10 individuals who were most of them were clerics.
Yes.
Who studied in the houses in Qom and in Najaf, in Iraq. So basically, Sheikh Naim Qasim was one of those founders.
Yes.
As well as others who are still at the hold positions in the Shura Council. So the Shura Council is like, it discusses the political, military, all aspects of the resistance, mm-hmm, that has to deal with the resistance, and they take decisions.
Yes.
So it's the highest council in Hezbollah.
Yes.
And actually, the post of Secretary General has been, at the beginning, a spokesman of this Shura Council.
Yes.
So the decision making is made inside the Shura Council. But, you know, the charisma of Sayyid Nasrallah and his own capabilities made him, you know, as the symbolic leader. So now I think that Hezbollah is going back to the previous phase, where the Shura Council is taking the leadership. Of course, Sheikh Naim Qasim is going to be the spokesman of this Shura Council, and also Sheikh Naim Qasim had a lot of responsibilities that are essential now, especially when we talk about the overseeing the Lebanese file.
Yes.
Inside Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Qasim used to manage the elections file and also the relation with other political forces in Lebanon. So I think it was a big message that this resistance is still strong. It's going to continue what it was doing, fighting the enemy, making sure that the sovereignty of Lebanon is kept safe. Also, in the relationship with the people who support the resistance, as well as the other political forces in Lebanon who are patriotic. It's a period of time. It's sensitive, but it's crucial. In the path of the resistance in Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Ali, you did mention that he has been a spokesperson for the resistance at Hezbollah. So the nice thing is that a lot of people are already familiar with him, with his speeches, with his face, and with his identity, of course. But just for some of the Western viewers, could you perhaps give us a brief history, perhaps of his age, maybe where he's from? Even some people say that he has a degree and he used to be a teacher.
Yes. Sheikh Naim Qasim, he is originally from South Lebanon.
Yes.
But he was born in Beirut,
mm-hmm.
in the administrative part of Beirut,
yes.
Not from the suburb of Beirut. He studied chemistry,
mm-hmm.
Later he used to teach in schools chemistry.
Nice.
Later on, he went to Najaf and Qom in Iran to have his theological studies. He later on became a cleric, a sheikh, and he joined the Islamic movement that was shaping in the 70s. He came back with his friends and comrades to Lebanon to establish the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. So he and, of course, he is older than Sayyid Nasrallah,
yes.
And Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin, but he was there at the beginning, at the founding moments of Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon. He knows how it is, how things are run inside the resistance. He is 71 years old, but what we know about him is that he is athletic.
Yes.
He takes care of his health, and of course, most of the Lebanese knows Sheikh Naim Qasim. He used to speak, he used to attend ceremonies, and especially when we're talking about internal Lebanese politics. Of course, this doesn't mean that he was far from the military wing and the issues that has to deal with the fighting the enemy.
Yes.
Sheikh Naim Qasim, I don't know if you have seen those pictures of him from the late 80s.
Before he joined in 91 as a deputy.
Meeting with the Mujahideen and the Islamic resistance fighters in South Lebanon and talking with them. So he is familiar with the resistance. He knows how the political scene is run in Lebanon and as well in the region,
yes.
Because he used to be the representative of Sayyid Nasrallah for regional and even international conferences.
And even before Sayyid Nasrallah, correct?
Yes, actually, even with Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi.
Oh, so he's been from the very beginning, as you mentioned.
Yes. So Sheikh Naim Qasim, as I said before, he used to manage the Lebanese political files And in this sensitive period, I think it's more important to take care of the internal situation in Lebanon, because what the Americans and the Zionists are preparing for the internal situation in Lebanon is dangerous. I think that Sheikh Naim Qassem is going to manage it carefully, because it's his file in the, from the years ago.
Well, we are going to talk a bit militarily and politically when it comes to Sheikh Naim Qassem. I do have to ask you, as we know, Sheikh Naim Qassem delivered a few, if I believe two or three, televised speeches after the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. And from the first appearance of him, when he first appeared on screen, did you have any expectations that he could perhaps be the next Secretary General?
Well, actually, because we know that he is the Deputy Secretary General, it was normal that he shows up on TV.
Yes.
With a recorded video to spoke with the Lebanese, with the people who support the resistance, and to show that the leadership is still working, no matter how far the enemy went in assassinating leaders in this organization. It was reasonable to say that Sheikh Naim Qassem is going to be the leader of this period.
Yes.
As I said before, he knows the situation. Maybe he's the he was the most active member of the Shura Council when Sayyid Nasrallah had a security, his own security reasons to remain out of sight. Sheikh Naim Qassem was active, meeting people,
exactly, yes.
When, going around in Lebanon, in Bekaa, in
exactly.
South Lebanon, in southern Lebanon.
It seemed this was divided at the time between Sheikh Naim Qassem and, of course, Sayyid Hisham Safiyuddin, when martyr would
exactly.
fall, commemorating the families and stuff like
exactly.
this.
Exactly. They used to visit the families of the martyrs. And Sheikh Naim Qassem is known by the political forces and parties in Lebanon.
Very well.
Some of them, they don't like him. Mm-hmm. It's understood because he has a strict speech regarding those forces in Lebanon who are, you know, aligned with the United States and the some of the forces that doesn't like the resistance. I think maybe they were shocked yesterday as the news came that Sheikh Naim Qassem was chosen or was elected to be the next Secretary General of Hezbollah.
One more thing I do have to ask you about Sheikh Naim Qassem. His appointment comes, as we mentioned at the very beginning, as a very sensitive stage in this war. And a lot of people are saying it was very dangerous for the group to announce his appointment. Do you believe he is indeed, I mean, as we know, Hezbollah has been very secretive about this, and they have all the right about his location. Hopefully he's safe, right? If he was not, they would not announce
well, actually, we hope and we ask God that he keeps him safe. And we are sure that now, maybe, probably, there are new security procedures to protect those leaders. And but we have to take into consideration one important thing in the ideology of Hezbollah.
Yes.
Whoever accepts a post, a senior post in Hezbollah, regards himself as a project to be a martyr. So it's not something that they are afraid of. Actually, those leaders, they know since the beginning of the 80s, that they are, they might be martyred anytime. And actually, whenever they speak, whenever they meet with people, they talk about martyrdom, and they express their wishing that they might finish their life by, being killed in the path of Allah as martyrs.
Mr. Ali, yesterday when the news did come out, the statement released by Hezbollah about the appointment of Sheikh Naim Asim as Secretary General, the supporters of the resistance and everyone who sides with the resistance, of course, could you just perhaps explain their feelings at the moment? Because usually when we received, unfortunately over the past month, a statement with a specific senior official's name in it, it wasn't such joyful news.
Yes, actually... And this maybe is being used, this this way of influencing the unconsciousness of the people here in Lebanon, especially the supporters of the resistance. The Zionist enemy has been working on influencing this consciousness and unconsciousness in a way that that portrays the Zionist entity as the almighty force that can reach any leader anytime they want, and this is not true. I think that the people received the information and the news about the election of Sheikh Naim Qasim as a new Secretary General in a positive way. Of course, it's going to be a push for those people who seek for such leadership in such hard times, because we have to admit it was a huge loss by the martyrdom of Sayyid Nasrallah and also Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin and all the military leaders in the resistance. But as the supporters of the resistance, they know that in the end there is going to be a leader. They were expecting this this move. And I think that in the future, as Sheikh Naim Qasim is going to speak more and more videos of him being released, of course, we understand now maybe it's hard for him to go live to speak with people. But of course, this is going to relieve the people, especially the displaced people, those who left their homes behind and went into safer places.
Yes.
Though there are no safe places in Lebanon, this was proved by the aggressions of the Zionist entity. We've seen more massacres being conducted by this enemy in Saida, in Sur, in Bekaa Valley.
Yes.
And we don't know, maybe they would go back to attack inside Beirut.
Well, I do have to ask you, Mr. Ali, as we have seen, as you have mentioned, actually, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's charisma was studied, actually, in universities abroad. Many people say that his leadership of Hezbollah during his time brought it to become a regional power. Of course, he brought something new to his predecessor, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi. What do you expect Sheikh Naim Qasim to bring? Perhaps new, or do you believe he's going to continue to work on the same path that we have been walking on?
I don't think that much would change with Sheikh Naim Qasim, because as I said before, he was one of the founders of Hezbollah, and he knows the way things are run inside the organization. So yes, of course, Sheikh Naim Qasim, I forgot to mention that he is sometimes he is looked at as an intellectual leader inside Hezbollah, because if you take a look at the books he wrote...
Yes, he has many books.
He has like 26 books, and he runs and manages some educational institutions.
Yes.
So he is someone who cares about education, about gaining knowledge, and of course through you know, spreading the culture of resistance. And in this times, in this in these hard times, it's more than important now to keep on going with the preaching and the you know, lecturing about the culture of resistance, the importance of supporting the resistance, and the means of the, you know, revolutionary ideas that the resistance is about. Because, you know, someone said before, no matter the castles, they do not fall when too much forces, you know, make sieges and surround it. It falls when the residents of this castle start asking, what's the use defending this castle? This is the moment when this castle is going to be defeated. And I think more than ever now, inside Lebanon and across the axis of resistance countries, I think it's more important now to go back to the idea of resistance, to define why we are resisting, why we are supporting the resistance, and what it means to face this barbaric terrorist enemy who has been massacring the Palestinian people for more than a year now in an unjust war. And I think that Sheikh Naim Qasim and, of course, many other brothers of Sheikh Naim Qasim are now maybe, of course, they are busy trying to, you know, to stress on these meanings and these principles. And I think in the coming period, as the political situation is going to improve more, when we talk about negotiations, and of course, as we are receiving every day, that the military action of the resistance is improving.
Yes.
So these two factors are going to take a push to the intellectual arena and the cultural arena, because the enemy, they thought that they defeated the idea of resistance in what they were doing, they have been doing since more than a year now, and especially since the late September.
Yes.
It's going to be important to watch these things in the coming weeks.
Well, I think you may be perhaps surprised a few of our viewers who are perhaps joining us for the first time, because a lot of time when specifically Western media and stuff cover something called resistance, or as they call it, terrorism, etc., people just automatically imagine just someone carrying up arms and running and fighting. And the way you talk about being intellectual and education, I mean, for those people who don't know, I mean, Islam actually talks a lot about it. Sayyid Hassan has talked a lot about it. And Sayyid Hassan always had his papers in front of him, and a lot of people always asked him, where did he get this information? It's from the research, from the education that he had, correct?
Exactly, because in the West, they don't talk too much about the houses.
Yes.
The schools, the religious schools where those leaders went to get their, you know, theology and stuff. They learn the, you know, the content inside Islam and the religion that elaborates and explains why you should resist the oppressor.
Yes.
If you take a look at the Quran, there are a lot of verses that talk about the importance of resisting those who oppress the people, the weak people. It talks about, you know, that Allah is going to reward those who support those oppressed people. And I think that it's a cultural, you know, conflict in the end.
It is.
Because those colonialists who came to Palestine, to colonize Palestine, they had the opposite ideas and the opposite culture of humanity.
Yes.
Because they want to eradicate those people, to cancel them, to of course they looted their lands, their homes, and in common sense you cannot accept this. Of course the religion, the Islamic religion, supports and pushes its followers to resist this situation. We cannot accept that a foreigner comes to our land to occupy our land, to kill our children, our brothers, and remain without any action, without any reaction. So This is about the conflict. The conflict is about this.
It is.
So no matter how, what they call us, terrorists, insurgents and stuff, it doesn't matter. It matters how we define ourselves and how we define our thoughts, our path in this struggle, because it's a humanitarian struggle in the end. Sayyidina Rasulullah before, during the last year, as he was speaking about the reason why Hezbollah entered this war to defend the Palestinian people, was stressing and explaining those ideas and principles that made Hezbollah use arms to defend the oppressed people in Palestine.
Well, with that, I'm afraid my time has run out. I'd love to thank my guest, as always, Mr. Ali Mourad, a writer and political researcher. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime officials' recent gathering near the Gaza Strip shows that a considerable portion of Israel's senior political officials feel emboldened enough to publicly declare their intentions to ethnically cleanse and then build settlements in northern Gaza. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, recently Israeli regime senior officials gathered at a settler movement conference hosted near the Gaza Strip, calling for ethnic cleansing and the construction of Israeli settlement in Gaza. Unlike what is often portrayed in the corporate media's coverage of such events, this wasn't some kind of far-right fringe. Inside what Israel has called a closed military zone, on October 21st, Zionist regime senior ministers and lawmakers gathered at a conference to discuss building illegal settlements in the Gaza Strip. Guarded by the Zionist regime military and organized by settlement expansion organization known as Nachala, the conference attendees made it clear what they believed must be done in order to build their Jewish supremacist apartheid colonies. You will witness how Jews go to Gaza and Arabs disappear from Gaza, said the conference's organizer and prominent settler movement leader Daniela Weiss. While the infamous Israeli regime security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir stated that there will be a transfer of all Gazan citizens through encouraging emigration and that we will offer them the opportunity to move to other countries because that land belongs to us. While quite often there is a focus on the like of Itamar Ben-Gvir and his equally as infamous religious Zionism party ally, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, it is important to note that members of the Zionist regime's most popular political party, Israeli regime PM Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud, were also in attendance. The Likud Party's social equality and advancement of the status of women minister, May Golan, said that taking territory from Arabs is the best way to hurt them the most. Golan, who was featured in a BBC News story as one of the primary sources for the Zionist regime's allegations that a premeditated mass rape campaign happened on October 7, has openly declared herself proud to be a racist as a fascist rally. Likud Party lawmaker Ariel Kalner, who had previously called for a second Nakba in Gaza, told MEE settlements in North Gaza and strategic places like the Philadelphia Corridor were supported by many members of his party. "I have no mercy. The only mercy we have is that we give them the chance to leave," said yet another Likud Party officer named Tali Gottlieb. Regular attendees of the conference also spoke to the MEE about the kind of real estate opportunities that will present themselves in Gaza, discussing how cheap it will be to move next to the sea. "It will be a bargain. Properties in Tel Aviv next to the sea cost 20 to 50 million shekels. Here we can sell cheap," said one Israeli settler. However, this is not the first Israeli settlement conference held to discuss the construction of illegal Jewish colonies in Gaza. These conferences date all the way back to January, with the first being held in Tel Aviv and also receiving the endorsement of senior Zionist regime government officials. In addition to this, the Nachala Settler Organization, responsible for putting on the conference, claims to have already secured a multi-million dollar deal for temporary settler housing in the Gaza Strip. While the prospects for such fantasies of the Israeli settler movement look somewhat distant or overall bleak, they believe wholeheartedly that they will have their wishes granted. Not only is Gaza's seafront real estate being discussed and put on the table for them, this is also the case of southern Lebanon, which the settlement movement has already drawn up designs for constructing illegal settlements, under the assumption that south Lebanon will be placed under Israeli occupation. What this conference shows is that a considerable portion of the Zionist regime's senior political officials feel emboldened enough to publicly declare their intentions to ethnically cleanse and then build settlements in northern Gaza. This conference is in no ways a far-right fringe. In fact, the various polls conducted concluded that up to 40% of Israelis support re-establishing settlements in the Gaza Strip. This is despite the Hamas Al-Aqsa storm operation against settlements and surrounding the besieged coastal territory. Additionally, the Gaza Strip is not religiously significant in Judaism, the way that the West Bank, Al-Quds, the Galilee, or even parts of Naqab are. When arguments are made in favor of annexing land and building settlements in the Gaza Strip, the most prominent points made are to do with teaching the Arabs a lesson or prime real estate, with very few points made regarding the significance of the land itself, beyond general statements about it belonging to Jews. Such conferences exemplify the prevalence of the goal to conquer and Judaize the land of Palestine by leading Zionist regime officials. While the Israeli opposition in the Knesset, led by Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, as its most prominent voices, may not send their party officials to such conferences, they do not speak out against the vast majority of its ideas proposed there. During their Yair Lapid-Naftali Bennett government, for instance, the project to Judaize the Naqab was placed as priority and the West Bank settlement movement was not hindered. At this time, it appears that the Israeli regime government is at least considering the idea of allowing the settler movement to construct settlements in the Gaza Strip in the event that they successfully manage to annex large portions of the territory, specifically the north.
Memories are sweet and heartwarming, but they also bring along the regrets of loss. People usually visit relics to alleviate this feeling. They visit the old neighborhoods, people, and houses that are full of memories. But reviewing the past torments my family, my compatriots, and me. Not only can we not go back in time, but we can't go back to where our past was formed. All that is left for us are movies that open our old wounds. Our house was lost in history and right in front of people's eyes. I am Edward Said. I was born in 1935 into a Christian family in this house. My father was a successful merchant who imported stationery from Egypt.
Not only the eldest, but he was also the only boy in the family. So I think we thought of him, his sisters, a bit as... He was getting a good deal, as they say.
I was 10 or 11 years old when I little by little realized the presence of Jewish immigrants in the city. Our city was experiencing a chaotic situation in those days. Our house was not far from King David Hotel, so I was terrified when that King David Hotel bombing happened.
Jewish terrorists bombed the King David Hotel in 1946. The wreckage could be seen from our house. I recall the rising sense of danger, British soldiers on the alert, and news of impending war between Palestinians and Jewish forces.
A year later, we went to Cairo with all our relatives and family members because the situation became too difficult. That was a one-way trip with no return date.
Most of my family left Jerusalem because they had to. Our house was in an area that was totally unprotected, and it was in an area that fell to the Haganah in, I think, February of 1948. There was, to my recollection, there was no militia, there was no organized resistance of any sort. By the time the fighting began in the latter part of 1947, it became impossible to live there. And there was a general sense of panic. And my family left at the end of December of 47.
In Cairo, my father sent me to an English language school, and I found my interests in literature. My father was a wealthy man with aristocratic morals. He was proud of his U.S. passport and asked everyone to call him William. He was very organized and cared so much about discipline.
In relation to me, he was very severe. I had four sisters. He was much more partial to my sisters. And for him, I was constantly to be reformed. And in many ways, he focused on certain parts of my body. For example, my back. He was very upset at the fact that I didn't have a military posture. So there was a lot of my childhood was devoted to training my back. Training it, he would say. And so on and so forth. So there was a lot of that. There was always my mother, who, of course, counterbalanced it. You know, and she tried to spoil me.
My mother was a gentle and kind woman. She took me to the best music teachers' classes of that time, and she motivated me to learn about music.
All of the things that matter to me today, music, literature, ideas really, I owe to my mother.
I was old enough to go to university, and I studied medicine for a few years, but I did not like my field of study. For this reason, I was expelled from Victoria College in Cairo in 1962. My father was disappointed with me and sent me to the United States to study. It was the same decision that my grandfather took for my father in Bulgarian Ottoman Wars period to keep his son out of it.
My father sent him because in those days, American law, we were American citizens, American law was such that if he didn't go by a certain age, he would lose his citizenship. So my father wanted to make sure that he kept his citizenship.
I happened to be a student at the American University at the time, from 60 onward, where Edward's sister was a classmate of mine. So I got to know the family, I got to know her, and then...
In the U.S., I chose what I was interested in and studied English literature. I was really interested in literature and made a lot of effort. Finally, I got my Ph.D. from Harvard University. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Joseph Conrad.
About 20 or 21, I'd read literally everything he'd ever written. And then, of course, I knew that he wasn't English and he was an outsider. And I didn't make any association with myself, although obviously he was answering to some very deep affinity that I felt with him.
Like me, Joseph Conrad was originally from another country and was born in Poland. He traveled to many countries and finally came to the U.S. and wrote his famous novels in English, just like me. I had a good life in the U.S. and everything seems to be in order until the event of 1967 that came as a great shock to me and completely changed the course of my life. Israel attacked the Egyptian army in the Sinai Peninsula. So six Arab states went to war with Israel. The war lasted only 6 days and resulted in the tripling of Israeli territories.
فکر میکردی که چند تا عملیات انجام میکنی اسرائیل به کشورهای عرب حمله میکنی ارتش عرب مجبور که چی از خودش دفاع میکنی و اینطوری اسرائیل نابود میشه فکر میکردی که ارتش عرب قوی هست و میتونی جنگ 6 روزه وقتی اومد نشونشون داده که نه ارتش عرب همش لطمه خورده و بالعکس اسرائیل زمینای کشورهای دیگه اشغال کردی نه فقط فلسطین
And that was important for understanding this shift in attitudes towards Israel and Zionism, because as the U.S. faced defeat in Southeast Asia, the victory that Israel represented in defeating the Arab states in 1967 was this seen as this incredibly positive sign of the West recovering its sense of purpose and its military prowess and so on.
And I first met him, he was just an American professor, but his connection with the Palestinian movement was after 67.
And then when the war broke out in 1967, I was desolated. I was in New York at the time, and I was completely shattered. The world as I understood it and knew it had completely ended at that moment. And it was shortly thereafter that I began for the first time, I had been in America already for 15 or 16 years, and I began for the first time to be in touch with other Arabs.
يعني في اثنين ادوارد سعيد اذا بدك في ادوارد سعيد قبل 67 ادوارد سعيد بعد 67
I think between 67 and the 1973 war when Israel expanded again he became increasingly concerned with the question of Palestine and the situation of Palestinians and of the Arab world in general
By 1970, I was completely involved. I had started to write in this country, and I was immediately politically involved up to my neck.
Edward also, at that time, began to realize that he is damn Palestinian, and it's okay to stand up for the downtrodden and to actually regain that identity. It was in that environment that I think.
It's because I discovered then that I had to rethink my life and my identity, even though it had been so sort of sheltered and built up in this completely artificial way, I had to rethink it from the start.
We did exactly what you expect us to do. We were just modern, we talk your language, we studied your language, and then all of a sudden this society here slapped them. They said, no, you are dirty Arabs because you couldn't even fight. The whole The whole war lasted only 6 days. That kind of immediate collapse of the Arab armies at that time had a very, very deep influence on those, and they felt insulted.
Now, after a few years of a seemingly successful life in the United States and teaching at one of America's best universities, I felt like nothing more than a fugitive. Nothing was the same as before.
He said that directly. I'll never be home. When someone like Edouard Said says, I'll never be home, that's something strange. But if you think like a Palestinian, you'll understand.
The idea of being a fugitive is just like being affected by leprosy. You feel alone in the middle of the crowd. A fugitive can never be expelled from his homeland and can never return to it. A fugitive feels like a parasite. A fugitive is an uninvited guest who has got nothing in common with his place of residence and is always considered a stranger. All Palestinians feel the same sense of exile. The memorable sentence by Yasser Arafat before the United Nations General Assembly on November 13, 1974.
I met him for a long period of time when he came to the United Nations here in November of 1974. And he had the speech that was cobbled together, and I was asked by him to put it into English, which he gave at the General Assembly. And then from then on, I started to see him regularly.
After this famous speech, the Palestine Liberation Organization was granted observer status at the UN, and the Palestinians were given the right to determine the fate of their inhabited territories. However, this situation did not last long. I became a member of Palestinian National Council for the first time 3 years before this speech, Palestinian Immigrants and Deportees Parliament. I felt like I had found my homeland again, and I had to fight to reach it.
What do you think of when you think of an Arab? Somebody with a towel on their head, camel, and maybe some sand. Want to throw a pyramid in there? Well, guess who's here? Right on our stage. This itself would not have been possible not long ago. Edward Said joins us, professor of English, Columbia University, member of the Palestine National Council, to which umbrella organization belongs, the PLO.
I spoke loudly about the reality of the Palestinian problems, and I even had to speak in front of pro-Israel Jews.
I think the main point is, if you want to negotiate some kind of peace with justice, you cannot legislate in advance who's going to represent whom. The Israeli position and the position of the ADL is that we are not only entitled to decide what to talk about, but we're going to decide who to talk to. Now, the Palestinians have their own representatives, and nobody has found any other representatives for the Palestinians except the PLO. After all, it was the Israeli government, A, that dispossessed the Palestinians, that destroyed Lebanon in 1982, killed...
Try as he or she might, a Palestinian finds it very difficult. I won't say impossible, but I think it's very, very hard. And I think most Palestinians are like most people. It's very hard for the Palestinian who feels himself or herself to have been the victim of injustice by Jews, Israeli Jews, to sympathize or imaginatively incorporate the history of the Holocaust and say, well, we forgive them for what they did. I mean, after all, they suffered this enormous, this colossal historical tragedy, the Jews did. And the fact that they are evicting us from our territory, that they are placing us under occupation, that they're treating us as third-class citizens, that they are killing our people, that they are confining us to camps, etc., 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 we understand. Nobody can understand that. I mean, you can grasp the first fact, the fact of the Holocaust, but you can't translate that into your own doom.
My mind has always been busy with this question. What is the reason behind the occupation of Palestine and the Western support for the occupier? In my opinion, this issue is rooted in the way the West looks at the East, and the Palestinian cause emerges in this point of view.
This war between peoples, a war which has been fought for generations, and which concerns the whole world, is, I believe, inextricably entangled with the fantasies, dreams, and ambitions of the West to rule and possess the East.
There's also a question of how Zionism conceives Arabs, and it has become current for Arabs to call Zionism a racist ideology. Now, what, Patrick Seale, is the basis of that charge?
Well, I know it's a charge which created outrage, which was first raised, I think, at the UN. They tried to dub Zionism as a racist thing. But you see, unfortunately, I think there is something in it. I mean, much as one hates to say so, but if you just look at some of the statements, say, of a man like Begin. I mean, he's always ranting about Jewish blood and how precious it is, with the implication, of course, that Arab blood is much less precious. And he says things like, Palestinians are animals walking on two paws. Or you remember his chief of staff at the time, Raful Eitan, talked about Palestinians being cockroaches in a bottle.
It is the default option of Europeans that the perfect and normal man is the same European man who has existed since ancient Greece. In the subconscious of a Western white man, an Eastern man is not considered an equal to a Western man in terms of humanity.
He talks about blood libel against the Jews, or of course his famous phrase at the time of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He said, if Goyim kill Goyim, what concern is it of ours? Now that, it seems to me, is an absolutely racial remark.
In another way, I'd like to reformulate and say that had there been in the United States, for example, immigration laws which said that only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants can emigrate and get a citizenship, then you as a Jew and I as a Palestinian would object. Now, the same law, in an inverse formulation of the same law, which says that only a Jew can emigrate to Israel, whereas a Palestinian who is born there and can...
مدخله إلى نقد الاستشراق هو اكتشاف يعني مبلغ الظلم والتشويه لتتعرض له قضية الشعب الفلسطيني.
So for him, the writing of Orientalism was actually shaped by his engagement with the question of Palestine.
My years of research in literary and historical texts led me to the theory that I presented in Orientalism.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care